The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, how can you talk about today's world conditions without sounding gloomy? How can you talk about current news and about projections into the future without sounding a note of despair, of pessimism, and being labeled a gloom and doom prognosticator? These feelings have become virtually contagious in the world today, whether you're looking at the big global problems of pollution, of too many people and not enough food, of a runaway arms race for all the talks of arms limitations, of the situation in the Middle East, or whether you're talking about private and personal health or crime that now reaches into every citizen's life, it seems, especially in the one nation where you would think there is no real reason for crime, Wonderland America, with everyone with an opportunity. Whether you're an international affairs professor, or a farmer, or a beautician, or a truck driver, you have got to think about the way of this world. You've got to think about conditions and circumstances around you. You read newspapers, you listen to news broadcasts, you see news on television. And in all of this has got to be a premonition, a sense of things kind of coming unglued everywhere, a feeling that we're living in the age of foreboding. Here we are in the United States of America approaching, actually into, the way many people act, our bicentennial anniversary. By a year from July 4th, 1975, will be the time of America's 200th birthday. Actually, some historians are claiming it ought to last for 13 months, which is why already people are getting all geared up for bicentennial observations, because from the time the first shot was fired until the final adoption of our Constitution and Bill of Rights, it took about 13 months in the agonies of that day that gave birth to a new country that was predicated upon the belief of the dignity of each individual human being. It was predicated upon the notion that a man was born free, that he ought to have certain precious inalienable rights and freedoms preserved for him. The freedom of speech, the right of lawful and legal assembly, the freedom to bear arms that people are even now, of course, contesting, the freedom, most importantly, perhaps, of religion. But yet, in spite of the fact that we should be approaching our 200th birthday with feelings of optimism, of looking back along the back road of America, and especially looking forward in that backdrop, or in that retrospective view, and looking forward with a great deal of optimism, and of real hope, and excitement, and exuberance for the future, of the great things that lie ahead of us, looking back at how far we have come, and looking ahead at how far we have yet to go, there isn't this feeling. Instead, we hear continually predictions of economic depression. We see the spectacle of a Congress with its ears laid back and its teeth firmly dug in, or its heels dug in, as it's being dragged balkingly, mulishly, along avenues it doesn't wish to go. And really, Gerald Ford isn't even dragging it very far, let's face it. Mr. Ford has had to speculate recently about the ease with which he can negotiate with the nation's enemies as compared with the difficulty in negotiating with the nation's Congress. There's talk of war. Mr. Kissinger going back and forth and up and down the length and breadth of the earth, of course, trying to solve problems and find solutions and back people down from postures of antagonism and hostility. A Mideast conflagration with potentially ominous consequences is considered distinctly possible at any moment. We don't know any morning we wake up whether we will see new Mideast war. And then, with jaws agape, we will look around to find what that's going to do to the oil that flows out of the Middle East towards the United States, as well as, and most importantly, all of Europe and Japan. It could be the spark which ignites World War III, and we all know that. There's speculation that a great deal of want is going to replace a great deal of plenty, even in the Western world. We have seen the food conference at Rome, and the spectacle that was, where a great deal of verbiage ended up being nothing but oratory, and where nothing was really solved. But many are now talking that it's not just oil, it's not just the want of certain energy sources, but most of the basic essential raw materials of the earth are beginning to dwindle and becoming in very short supply. Many now say depletion of the world's raw materials, especially energy, portends a much more austere life for citizens of industrial nations. Here are other countries, Iran among them, Saudi Arabia, tiny Kuwait, Even Venezuela, other OPEC countries such as Algeria, striving mightily to plunge headlong into the 20th century. With national populaces, in the case of Iran, for example, more than 60% illiterate, with Kurdish nomads and others making up vast sections of the land, with the very impact of modern technology, such as the importation of tens of thousands of automobiles, trucks, and buses, and of even road-building equipment, finding itself jammed on roads that are too tiny to even take care of the equipment to go out and build additional roads. I mean, these countries that are having headaches about how to spend all the incredible billions of dollars they earn in their excesses of their balance of payments because of the money of the quadrupling of oil prices are striving mightily, Iran a case in point, to become gigantic superpowers. Their goal is to become the fifth largest nation, the fifth most powerful on the face of the earth by the turn of the century. Isn't that an amazing goal? It really is. I mean, I just don't understand that. It doesn't say that they are the nation that has determined they are going to have their entire populace educated and literate, or their entire populace fed and clothed, or that they're going to find a solution to cancer, or that they're going to eradicate man's modern diseases. I don't really read of any giant humanitarian instincts except that they want their people to be in the same kind of a status that we are in the United States. But now, why would anybody want to come to our place? Why would any other country want to develop to the point that what we ourselves develop makes us victims of our own technological genius? Why would someone else want to be a doctor in the laboratory who creates a Frankenstein, which when he gets up off the laboratory table, picks up the scalpel and attacks the doctor? Let's stop to imagine for a moment what the world would be like if some of the smaller nations, the have-not nations, the so-called developing nations, had what the United States has. Can you imagine a Vietnam with all the wealth of the United States, with its nuclear arsenal? Can you imagine the per capita wealth? Actually, people in Iran right now, well, tiny Kuwait is even a better case in point, they could pay them a salary for the next 15 years for doing nothing comparable to the salary, the minimum wage, the average salary, even better said, in the United States today. That's just how much money some of those countries have got. But can you imagine the resultant pollution? Can you imagine the traffic jams? What would happen? Well, if you know human nature at all, then the same thing would happen there that is happening in the United States. The disintegration of social values, the disruption of the home, and the disintegration of family life, changing sex roles, blatant, wild, rabid, obscene, chaotic toboggan slide into immorality, licentiousness, and pornography, a total destruction of moral values. That would gradually erode away the very fiber of the character of the nation, what character some of those countries may have. Then there would be all the problems of pollution. Pollution that literally threatens to engulf us. For example, very recently, only a few years ago, it was reported that the United States and its people and its industries spewed out about 360 million tons of garbage. That's 5 years old, that figure. 1.5 billion tons of solid waste from mines and factories, 142 million tons of air pollutants, and over 50 billion gallons of polluted water. Heat from power plants, heat from nuclear reactors, heat from factories, which flows from cooler streams into warming streams, causes eutrophication of the waters. Noise is mounting. The grinding of gears, the whistle and the blast and the shriek of factories and sirens and horns, the steam drills, the power hammers, the passing trucks and buses, the noise levels of our society that have already caused an enormous amount of hearing loss, and not the least of this, even the aptitude of so many teenagers for loud rock and roll music all plugged in with their little pocket transistor turned up at gigantic volume with their earplug in. And it's been absolutely proved that you can drive mice and guinea pigs and rats insane with that kind of thing. You can simply tune up the volume in your cage, and after a while, they're literally running up the walls. Human beings go to these discotheques, and a little later on, they actually have measurable hearing loss. So noise is mounting. You've heard the case, of course, of Kon-Tiki, and then of Ra-2. But in Thor Heyerdahl's second voyage across, I believe he landed in South America, they were talking about how there was not a single day in the vastness of the Atlantic Ocean when they did not see waste in the form of plastic bags and orange peels and garbage and oil slicks. They were never out of sight of globs of oil floating on the surface of the sea. Now we hear of some of the most incredible statements that hidden pollution in the form of aerosol cans is a gigantic threat. And some of the leaders have been told recently that the potential in some of these little spray cans that are being used of destroying the ozone layer of the earth is really not just a marginal little problem. And seven separate studies have said that they confirmed this. A University of California chemistry professor said that seven different studies during the past year agree that freon-type gases in spray cans pose a catastrophic long-term threat to the Earth's ozone radiation shield. His name is Dr. Frank S. Rowland, and he testified before a newly formed federal interagency task force on research by seven scientific groups. And those results, he warned, concluded that if aerosol propellants known as fluorocarbons continue to be released into the environment at the present rate, the layer of ozone 15 to 30 miles high will be depleted by anything from 10 to 40% in about 50 years. And he said, you're not talking about something marginal. He said at the panel's first public meeting, you're talking about something that is catastrophic. Years ago, I used to attend almost every annual Association for the Advancement of Science meeting, wherever they were held, Boston, New York, Chicago. The last couple of years, I have not gone, but some of our correspondents have, and the head of our news bureau. And his name is Gene Hogberg. He was accompanied by a couple of other fellows whose names I don't recall right now, but they're in the current Plain Truth. And the articles they brought back from there, and about a two-page spread in the current Plain Truth, the third, by the way, of our bi-monthly publication, tabloid, that comes out with real socko articles straight from the shoulder that are really powerfully put, shorter and more to the point, as well as a continuing series on the incredible human potential by my father, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, and my continual feature, Speaks Out column, in the Plain Truth. You can have it, by the way, by return mail. Articles on these subjects that I take up on the World Tomorrow radio program, every single issue, up to 25, 30 and more articles, pictures, graphically illustrated. We've got international known commentator and columnist articles in there as well. For instance, Norman Cousins is in the current one. So is Art Buchwald's column. You'll enjoy that about the CIA and Cuba.
For 40 years, the Plain Truth magazine has been supplying the missing dimension in education. The Plain Truth is published monthly as a facet of Ambassador College's in-the-home educational service. It maintains an editorial policy that incorporates this missing dimension in education, biblical understanding. The Plain Truth, timely, informative articles, deal with subjects covering success in business, recreation, politics, religion, farming. Each issue not only documents the state of today's society, but offers hope for a better world tomorrow. To serve its more than 6 million readers, The Plain Truth is published in 5 languages and is available without price or obligation to all who request it. Join the growing worldwide readership. Request your subscription to the magazine with a 40-year history of educational service to mankind. The Plain Truth. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales, 2001.
And The Plain Truth is really an exciting publication now. We've tried to fight inflation, too, because we've gone to newsprint, and we are now printing it simultaneously in 2 places in the United States and elsewhere in countries around the world, in England, Australia, and elsewhere. And it's far more up to the moment, coming to you rapidly with current conditions as they apply, and you're going to see a great deal of concern over prophecy, over the fulfillment of Bible prophecy, as we see current world trends and conditions fulfilling some of the major prophecies of the Bible. That's in The Plain Truth, it's called. It's a tabloid now, coming out twice as often with twice the impact, and it's absolutely free of charge. And while you're at it, why don't you request that booklet about how to understand prophecy? That's a book that everyone needs. How to understand it, about some of the biblical symbolism and the rest of it. Well, you know, as you look at the world in retrospect, you look at the United States in context of our approaching 200th anniversary, our 200th birthday party, which is surely going to be a gigantic slam-bang affair in these United States. I should imagine that at all levels, from federal all the way down to local and civic and church groups alike, we're going to see every kind of celebration. I'm planning to do a one-hour special and have it shown all around the United States, the entire history of our country in retrospect and where we go from here, as a commemorative program for our 200th anniversary. There will be many other occasions that we as a church and as a group, the colleges, will be involved in around the country as we look toward that 200-year anniversary of the United States. But as you look beyond this immediate future of ours, as you look back in retrospect at all the goals, the hopes, and the cherished dreams of our forebears and our founding fathers, how far have we come? Are we as a country going to survive into the next century? If the human race is to survive into the next century, what is really going to be required? You hear talk of war, speculation that want will replace plenty, pronouncements that the post-war balance of power is shifting away from the West and into the Mideast of all places, into Arab hands, an incredible turn of affairs just in about a year and a half. Let me tell you that before September of 1973, I doubt if there is a person living in the United States who could have remotely predicted that some of the wealthiest countries on the face of the earth will be some of the tiny places in the Persian Gulf they never even heard of before. It took the Yom Kippur War and the consolidated cooperative effort of the Arabs to use their oil as a weapon and as a tool for blackmail to bring about this enormous shift of wealth from the have countries, the wealthy countries of the West, over into the Middle East. So the balance of power is shifting. And America, many feel, is going to become increasingly helpless as less developed nations become increasingly more difficult to get along with, swinging their weight around in world markets, in the world economy, and even militarily. I've done many programs recently about the absolute stupidity, even though it is justified from an economic standpoint because it supposedly helps our balance of payments deficits, of selling enormous amounts of arms to some of the countries in the Middle East, of Africa, and for that matter, around the world. The United States leads the Soviet Union by many billions of dollars in being the dubious champion in the arms race by being the first of all countries on the face of the earth as trafficker in arms. Did you know that Iran, for example, is a leader in all the world in hovercraft? Hovercraft? That's these funny, almost manta ray-looking type of military vehicles that can ride on a cushion of air by gigantic fans, just like aircraft propellers, that force a column of air below them. And they can ride along the surface of the water just a few feet off the waves of the ocean and then go right on up, sliding up over the land on that column of air and come inland that way below normal radar in most cases. Did you know that Iran leads the world in hovercraft? I imagine most all of those were built in the United States. There's an excellent article in the current number of National Geographic where it showed pictures of Iranian soldiers armed with U.S. weapons storming ashore out of a hovercraft that had just settled to the ground. It showed pictures of some of the refineries and the oil wells, and the country in general was the subject of an article about the Shah of Iran and his desire to make past Persian glories leap to life in the midst of the 20th century. So you have to ask the question about survival beyond our 200th anniversary. You look at all that is happening to us today, and it's a real enormous problem of how to sort it all out. We just got through having another meeting where we were projecting the next few telecasts we're going to do, and a couple of proposed trips that I have up to Europe and the Middle East, interviews with leaders of Arab countries and the Israeli leadership alike, as well as interviews with leaders in Europe on Europe's staggering economy, on the shifting political scenery there. And we were talking about current conditions in the United States and the kind of programs we would like to do, including in-depth surveys into the private lives of elderly people living on fixed incomes who have high medical costs, and what the enormous spiral in runaway inflation is doing to them, how devastating what is happening in our country is to the rank and file of the people who were the muscle and the labor force of the United States in those years when we were plummeted by the means of World War II. from a comparative nation of maybe the 5th, 6th, 8th, or 10th in status in this and that and the other bracket. But there was no question about the time of the end of World War II of who was truly number one in the entirety of the world. Well, the labor force, the Rosie the Riveter, and the guy who was out there welding those Kaiser ships together that slid off the ways in that sudden city they built up there in Oregon along the banks of the Columbia River to the tune of one per day long before the war was over. That town was called Vanport. It was just about destroyed by a gigantic flood in years later, but those prefabricated homes were thrown up by the thousands, and workers went in there by the tens of thousands. I mean, people from all over the Midwest and the South, people who were farmers, people who had never even had much education. Suddenly they were welders and riveters and they were machinists, and they got quick training. You know, in a way, Iran is trying to do the same thing today. With the same kind of suddenness of just massive infusions of people who have not really had the skills before, becoming skilled laborers to try to grind out the productivity of a modern nation, a virtual cornucopia of the flow of goods and services that makes a nation great. Well, we did that. But you know, the people that had the muscle to produce the arsenal of democracy that America became are many times now people up in their 70s, up in their late 60s, who are living on fixed income. When they were given pensions either by the government, civil service, by corporations and companies, or are given state or federal aid in some form or another. And of course, you've been reading about the food stamp problem, and we want to do a program or two on that, by the way, and to get with our television cameras, which are portable, into some of the scenery where those things are taking place. But I'll tell you, when you see and listen to some of the agonies of our people as we approach our 200th birthday, while we, on the one hand, are speculating about giving away billions of dollars abroad, while we're able to sell as well as to give away some of the most super sophisticated weaponry in our entire national arsenal to countries our own Secretary of State says we may soon find ourselves locked in deadly combat with, and at the same time, the poor of our own country, many of them wage earners and the very muscle and backbone of America in those days when it became great, are being ignored and neglected. And some of the stories you hear about this food stamp program and where some of that money ends up, you hear about some of these elderly people that have to go into the local area where they get those stamps, and they have to wait in line day after day after day, and maybe they live 25 miles out in some star route or some rural route somewhere, and then they've got to go all the way into town and they are ignored and put off. It's a real hassle for some of those people to even get the help that the government and your taxes are trying to offer them. I think, I've always said that authority is an amazing thing. And I've always said the less you have of it, the more the other guy had better look out. I know that the smaller the official, the more petty he is, the more awesome his incredible power and his ego. I've run into that time and again in this life. I mean, all the way from a traffic flagman that surely must be the lowliest person in any authoritative job, to elevator operators, to clerks or waitresses, or especially people who deal with the general public from an official capacity, such as receptionists and secretaries at city and county and state-type offices. And when you run into food stamp programs, or you have people who are administering federal programs like that to other human beings, it doesn't take very long, and the ability to empathize, well, even the ability to sympathize with these people is gone. We were discussing the other evening about how people could ever go into the job of being a mortician, or even being a doctor, or an ambulance driver. The first on the scene is some of these incredible bloody wrecks where you got to pull these moaning, screaming victims out of automobiles, and you have to witness with your own eyes severed legs and arms and bleeding human beings. It's a horrible job. Somebody's got to do it. You know, in talking to professionals who do that kind of job, they will tell you that soon, it's a transition that takes place, they just aren't really fazed by it like they would have been as a private citizen stumbling upon something like that for the first time. They have to grow a few calluses to it. Well, unfortunately, that same process seems to occur to those in service jobs where they're dealing with the poor and the afflicted, the elderly, the infirm. And they can and oftentimes do treat those poor people just like a herd of cattle. And I'll tell you, there's quite a story to be told. I used to wonder, why does God in the Bible so repetitiously, over and over and over again, in chapter after chapter of the Bible, indict Israel and Judah and every other nation, all Gentile nations, people, continually for all the deceit, for the hypocrisy, and for what he calls the cause of the fatherless and the needy? Why does he continually talk about the way the poor are set upon? Well, I look around the country and I see, now look, we've got Social Security, we've got all of these wonderful military pensions, we've got these disability checks going out to people who were injured, we've got our federal hospitals and state and county and church operated, and we've got our private hospitals operated by various charitable organizations, we've got the fantastic job that the Shriners do for crippled children, we have all of these wonderful examples of people who are trying to help. You go to some of the big community hospitals in the United States and you see that there are many, many volunteer workers there. Usually middle-aged and older women who may be widowed, who don't have a lot to do with their time, who want to help somebody. And so by the dozens, they do voluntary hospital work. And you just assume, why, sure, we're taking care of our poor people. No. No, we're not. No, there are people inside the United States who starve to death every year. There are elderly people whose bodies are found after they starve to death in a cold, unlit, dank, walk-up, brownstone apartment somewhere who just, frankly, couldn't survive on the pitiful little income they were receiving. And you know one thing I've found in trying to administer programs of aid and help to people inside a church organization? I have found that oftentimes you can lay the ultimate blame for that right at the door of their own children. I have found many cases I could tell you in living flesh and blood color on television and show you the faces of the people where there have been elderly women, men too, but in the case I'm thinking of now, women, who are grandmothers, who have several living children, who maybe have jobs, maybe they're scattered around the country, and that woman is put in some home someplace and never visited, never gets a letter, and is overlooked by her own relatives. There was an interesting article some years ago about how people just abandon their own flesh and blood after they reach a time where they're just kind of hard to have around and not all interesting to chat with and a little bit of a bother to kind of help. Well, there are a lot of programs we're going to be doing, and we're going to take our cameras and microphones and get right down inside the heart and the core of some of these problems in our country and keep flailing away on them, see if we can wake some of us up to our senses to see where are the areas where we've got to change. If we're going to survive long enough to have a 200th birthday, we better begin making some changes in this country, I'll tell you that. So if you write for the Plain Truth, it's absolutely free of charge, there is no price. Find out whether or not it's really what it says it is, the Plain Truth. There's no request for money, there's no follow-up, no one's going to call on you unless you, of course, request it first. So be sure to request the Plain Truth, and remember, it's absolutely free, there is no charge. All you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World to Borrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.